All right.
Case number 10-1289 et al. Hewitt Power Construction Co. Petitioner to the National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Roberts for the petitioner, Mr. Kim for the respondent.
Good morning. Kiewit Power Constructors maintains a zero tolerance policy for threats and work and acts of workplace violence. And pursuant to that policy, they discharged two electricians who, while their crew was receiving a warning for extending their breaks and essentially disregarding their employer's instructions to break in place and maintain their breaks to the allotted 15 minutes. These two employees threatened the superintendent that they had been out of work for extended periods of time and that if they ended up losing their jobs, things would get ugly and that the superintendent had better bring his boxing gloves.
Now, as you know, the board decided that that was a figure of speech.
Yes,
but... Now, what deference do we owe to the board on such a finding of fact?
Well, the finding of fact, they accepted the ALJ's credibility resolution that they did make that they did use the...
They said what they said, but the ALJ interpreted it as a figure of speech, that it wasn't, in fact, a threat. Don't we owe significant deference to that?
Well, I don't think so in this case, Your Honor, because I think that, in essence, what you're saying is, in this particular case, the ALJ credited the employees testified that they didn't use the term boxing gloves. Their position was that they simply said there would be consequences. The judge discredited that. And what the board did was purport to accept the judge's credibility resolution, but then turn around and apply a state of mind that was inconsistent with that. In other words, they kind of had their cake and eat it too. They wanted to get
They said, we believe you said it. We believe you said, bring your boxing gloves and the SF. But that's a figure of speech. There was,
well,
I don't think a threat occurred there.
What I would say to that is that the board under the Allentown Mack, the Supreme Court's Allentown Mack decision, the inferences they draw from the evidence have to be reasonable. And I would suggest that that's not a reasonable inference in the context of this case for several reasons. One, the very parties, not only did the superintendent, it's not just a matter of the superintendent interpreting it as a threat. The union's business agent acknowledged that it was a threat and acknowledged that the terminations were valid under the collective bargaining agreement.
A threat of what? A threat that physical harm?
A physical harm. That they acknowledged that it was, in fact, a threat of physical harm. So the part, not only the person who was the subject of the threat, but the parties to the collective bargaining relationship viewed it as a threat.
Was that before the ALJ?
Yes, the page number. There's a letter in the record where the union actually acknowledges that. I think it may be around page 317, if my memory is correct. Well, it's going to be further than that. Maybe 370 something. There's a letter in there where the union drops the grievance at the third step and accepts the discharges. Well, I'm not laying my fingers on it, Your Honor, but there is a letter from the business or from the union's international representative to the employer at the third step that is one of the exhibits in the record where they drop the grievance and say that they acknowledge that there's no violation of the contract.
That's a different question.
All right. I'm sorry.
That's a different question. They acknowledge that it was,
the business agent was present at the time that the two individuals were terminated.
The business agent testified that it was a threat?
The testimony was that the business agent asked the employees what they said. The business agent had a conversation with the two employees before they even got into the room with the employer.
We're getting further than really all I'm asking. You said that the business agent acknowledged that it was a threat.
Yes, he did.
Where was that?
Well, it's in the record. He acknowledged that, as Pete Raya was the business agent, And the testimony was that he asked the employees, what did you say? They repeated what they said, and he said, it sounds like a threat to me. And I can't cite to the specific page right
That's
now, Your
JA
Honor.
JA-422. When Bond insisted that he'd only told Watts that there would be consequences, Rayo remarked that it sounded like a threat to him.
Correct, Your Honor. So I think that in this case, the board's inferences from this are really not reasonable at all. The parties viewed it as a threat.
The board's position on that question is that it's not a question of subjective. It's a question of whether it was objectively reasonable as a threat.
Yes, and I would say objectively on its face, it is a threat. There was it was a threat of physical violence. I mean,
isn't,
I don't know.
Isn't that something we're supposed to defer to the board on? I mean, it would certainly be reasonable to read it in the way you're saying, but we have to say that the board was unreasonable in reading it as not a threat.
Well, I think they were unreasonable. I understand what you're saying, but my position would be is that that's an unreasonable inference. Having accepted the ALJ's credibility resolutions and the testimony of the parties themselves, the board has to draw according to Allentown Mac, all the reasonable inferences from the evidence. And I would submit that the only reasonable interpretation of that was the one the parties gave it, which was that it was a threat.
So then,
Judge, even if there was some element of ambiguity to it, the fact of the matter is the board found that it weighed in favor of protection. They didn't just find that it was a neutral factor. They found that in essence, whatever they said, that the threat of using boxing gloves supported a finding of protection. And I think that's contrary to this court's decisions in Felix Industries and Aristuke, that you don't have to show, it doesn't, the board's position in this case is that you have to have violent or extreme conduct or flagrant.
If that were what the board's position was, I think you'd be absolutely right.
Because well, I think it is the board's position
well,
because
the
they cite.
The board was careful to say that they weren't insisting on that it be a physical threat. It's just that they take these different things into account and they don't regard this as going over the line of, you have a beautiful phrase, animal exuberance. Under these circumstances.
Well, I think they quote Prescott Industries,
right,
which is an old case for the proposition that employees are entitled, when they're engaged in otherwise engaged in concerted activity.
They're entitled to get angry, right? They're entitled to get angry, these kind
yes,
of things.
Yes, yes, but there's a limit to how far they can go, and it's a four-factor test. The Atlantic Steel test is a four-factor test. You look at I think highly important here is that this case there was no provocation at all. The employer is conceded to have been acting lawfully and within its rights.
Not only was there no provocation for this, but I think the record is wrong. The board says that Judd and Bond both said, one said it was going to be ugly, better bring his boxing gloves, if they were terminated. He never said anything about terminating them or even laying them off. He said, they asked, are we going to get another warning if we do this this afternoon? And he said, yes. And suddenly both of them see that as a firing and say, I've been out of work for a year. If you do this, it's going to get ugly, or you better bring boxing gloves. So there was no provocation, at least the way I read the record, that he never mentioned, Watts never mentioned termination or being laid off.
No, there was no.
And as far as this Prescott, reliance on Prescott, the board cites Prescott and then says, consistent with the foregoing principles, meaning Prescott, we find the remarks by Judd and Bond fall short of the kind of unambiguous physical threat. Now, we have said that is not needed, and we've said that over and over again.
Repeatedly said that, and Section 10C of the Act is clear that you can terminate someone for cause even if it arises in the midst of otherwise protected activity. I would point out there was a union business agent there. This was a stable relationship. There was respect between the employer and the union. There was a working grievance arbitration provision. They had every right to grieve or even arbitrate the discipline.
Who was the one remind me from the record, who decided to terminate them?
It was
Mr. Watts?
It was not the superintendent. It was his superiors. There were two
Mr.
or three
Holmes.
Managers, Hutchins and It was the construction manager was the final say in it. There were like three managers at the higher levels that made
Mr. Watts was pretty young, wasn't he? He'd only been there recently out of college.
He was a fairly new, fairly young superintendent. But quickly, I'd like to say that there was a working relationship. There was no provocation. These people were trying to dictate their own terms and conditions of employment, which the law is absolutely clear that the employees cannot dictate their own terms. They flaunted the employer's position that they should break in place, and they decided that they weren't going to.
No one disputes that. Am I right that no one disputes that when the company made the statements to them, that wasn't an unfair labor practice, right?
No, no. There's no allegation of that. I mean, the employer was well within its rights, and there was a recourse. There was recourse available, but it certainly wasn't the kind of recourse that the employees chose. And this distinguishes this case from a lot of cases.
So is it your position that whenever an employee says anything that raises the specter of physical violence, that's sufficient grounds for termination?
Well, yeah.
I mean, did anyone really think this was an invitation to go back and put boxing gloves on, and that the next time that they would be there with boxing, but if there was a warning given in the afternoon that both sides would have boxing gloves?
Well,
is that a reasonable view that anyone thought that?
It was a reasonable view that it was
just boxing gloves.
Did anyone?
No, wait, hold on. Let's just talk about the boxing gloves. That's the language you used. Did anyone
I don't think that.
So we're dealing in the realm of hyperbole, at least, right?
Well, yeah, the boxing gloves. I'm not saying that anyone thought that they were going to come. They were actually put boxing gloves on, but it was a reference to fighting, and I think that was how.
Now you're in the realm of interpretation, right?
Well, there's no question that you asked the superintendent. He did believe that. They sent in. The record shows that
subjective belief is a factor, but it's not decisive here, right?
I didn't say it was decisive, but I'd just like to point out in response to that Watts. That they asked him to stay away from the two individuals when they called him in the next morning. They were careful to avoid any kind of confrontation between the two. And I think the record reflects that he was genuinely concerned about his physical safety.
Well, I think the dissent points out it is not the words themselves, but the manner in which they are delivered and the surrounding circumstance that convey the speaker's intent. And here, the speaker felt threatened.
Well, and
the
superintendent,
Watts.
Yes, and the
okay.
And I think you cannot ignore the judge's credibility findings. I don't think you can kind of have it both ways. I mean, in this case, it was a credibility dispute, and he credited the superintendent. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts.
Just one more question. What do you do with that Lisco case?
Lisco, I think, was one.
If you take my truck, I'm kicking your ass right now.
You know, that was a provocation case and a pretext case. There was a lot of the cases that the board cited are ones where the judge found that the employer did not actually rely on that profanity was commonly used, that those kind of conduct. And so those were pretext cases, Your Honor. This is not a pretext case. The board does not contend that that these people were disparately treated. There was a zero tolerance policy that no one disputes. So I think Lisco and Vault and some of the other.
There's another big difference in Lisco, and there the threatened company official said, I didn't feel.
That was another distinction there. But I do think that they turned on pretext in all of those cases.
All right, thank you. Ms. McKinney?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Renee McKinney, and I represent the respondent and cross-petitioner in this case, the National Labor Relations Board. We ask that this Court enforce the Board's order and deny Kiewit's petition for review because employees Judd and Bond did not lose the protection of the Act through their conduct and because Kiewit readily admits that the sole reason for their discharge was their statements to Superintendent Watts, which the board reasonably found were protected.
But what's wrong with the company saying, look, in our company, you can't even joke about fighting. We just don't even joke about fighting. And if you cross that line, you're going to be fired. What's wrong with the company having that policy?
The company can have such a policy.
But this company did, right?
Yes, the company had a zero tolerance for violence policy.
Right.
But what the company cannot do is infringe on employees' rights under Section 7 to act in a protected, concerted manner, to protest the terms and conditions of their employment.
Yes, they can. If the policy is you can't even joke about threatening, if the employee can't then decide, well, I'm going to actually, my Section 7 rights include joking about threatening. I thought, how can you do that?
Had the employees joked about violence, I can understand your Honor's concern, but that's not what happened here. What happened here is the employees, with knowledge that if they had three strikes, they'd be discharged.
Wait, but the way I characterize it is joking about violence, I thought that was the most helpful construction to the board, that they were joking about violence. You're saying they weren't joking about violence.
Well, and at one point, I think Judd in the transcript says that he was just kidding.
Right.
Which I don't think the ALJ even cited. So, but the board's construction is that these were, as you said earlier, figures of speech. That what they were actually invoking by talking about boxing gloves and it getting ugly was their right to the grievance and arbitration process, which is a contest. It is a match between the employees and the employer. And the it getting ugly was simply a colloquialism. It meant that it wasn't going to be a pleasant experience should they lose their jobs over their refusal to take a break where they felt unsafe and where they believed that their health was in danger.
How about the dissents? And this is something opposing counsel pointed out, the lack of provocation for this language. The dissent said they had been out of work for a significant period, adding a sense of desperation to their threats.
Yes, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, that's part of the circumstances. There was no provocation. He said, you can't break here. And they said, if we do it this afternoon, are you going to write us up? And he said, yes. And then suddenly they say, well, if I get laid off, it's going to get ugly. If I get fired, I've been out of work for a year, you better bring your boxing gloves.
Well, I think that there is, on the record, a policy where, and the board cited it, where employees, if they were written up three times, they had the oral warning, the written warning, and the third warning would be a dismissal or a suspension. And so I don't think that there's no provocation in the form of an unfair labor practice, is what the test says, not no provocation at all. The board didn't make a specific finding about any other kind of provocation, just that there was no unfair labor practice provocation.
So is it your position that the provocation was they'd get the third warning, which would, that afternoon, which would then result in either suspension or termination? That was this provocation?
I can't say that that was provocation because the board doesn't say specifically it was provocation, but it certainly was part of the circumstances that the board relied on when they looked at whether the employees, whether their remarks should be lost the protection of the act or not.
Let me ask you about our decision in Felix Industries, in which we said we rejected the rule that employees engaging in protected activity could not be dismissed unless they were involved in flagrant, violent, or extreme behavior, and we said that that no threat of or physical violence accompanied this insubordinate vitriol, which was repeatedly calling the supervisor an effing kid. That the fact that there was no threat or physical violence accompanying that did not mean that it was not a threat.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean, that was language that was profane, but was not a threat. Here we've got two men saying it's going to get ugly and you better bring your boxing gloves.
Right. Well, I think contrary to opposing counsel's view, the board has at least in Felix on remand and specifically in the Starbucks case, they recently decided that when an employee, that there is a line that an employee can cross and that line may not include threats of violence. In Starbucks, for example, what the employee did was basically follow an executive for blocks, shouting threats like, you know, vague sort of threats and curses and mocking him and laughing at him. And that was enough to exclude that employee from the protection of the act. I don't think that there's any basis to say that in this case that the board did not observe that your rule that this court laid down in Felix. There's just, it's just not here. I think that, in fact, the board has, when appropriate, looked at comments or threats that were not threats of violence, but that were simply inappropriate or obscene remarks, and
I
has appropriately.
The circumstance that this was done in front of all the other or several other workers, that seems to me to I don't know that either the board or the ALJ talked about it that much, except in terms of, well, this is a protected activity type thing. But the effect it had on other workers, if they hear two employees making, whether it's hyperbole or not, making threats of violence.
Well, I think two things, Your Honor. First, that the board did discuss the presence of the other workers. What Superintendent Watts did was he went team by team, mm-hmm. and on.
But did the board discuss the effect? I know they discussed that as part of the location of it, and
yes, exactly,
and so forth, but not the effect of other employees of hearing two of their coworkers issue threats, whether they were hyperbole or not. They didn't discuss that.
I can see your point. Yeah, I can see your point.
What do you think about that?
Well, on page 2 of the DNO, I don't have the transcript, the joint appendix site, but it's page, I think that's 433. But the board does take into account the fact that the employees did hear what was said to, the employees were there when Watts gave the warnings, and the employees heard it, other employees heard it. But that team, specifically Holloway's team, consisted of Judd and Watts and of an apprentice, Dwayne Teeters. That was the whole team besides the foreman, Holloway. So all those employees were there, and the employer chose to present those warnings right there, and the board concluded that they took the risk that employees would respond right then and there too.
Can you say some more about whether this is inconsistent with Felix, about the statement that it's not, in our opinion, that it's not required,
mm-hmm.
That it be a threat of physical violence?
Well, I think that what this court said was that, I have it on, I guess that's 1055 of Felix.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's just, in this case, there's no, what the board says is that the nature of the remarks, the nature of the outburst, when you take all the factors into account.
You don't think the board is requiring that in order to find for the employer it has to be a threat of violence?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I think what the board was saying is that they were, I think, addressing the dissent, too, the dissent's idea that this was a threat of physical violence and that Watts may have subjectively.
Didn't Felix use the word vitriol to describe what was going on? That sounds a little different than
yes, Your Honor.
Involved here.
There was, right, in Felix.
How many times did the employee in Felix engage in the vitriol?
I think it was 3 times.
3 times, yeah.
Yeah, and here the employee simply responded once to Watts handing out of warnings, and it was immediate, and it was a heightened state of emotion, but there were certainly no further comments. Well, I see that I'm out of time, Your Honors.
All right.
Thank you for your time.
You. Does Mr. Roberts have any time? All right, why don't you take 1 minute?
I'd just like to add some page sites that I was unable to provide on where the union dropped the grievance is,
yeah,
Joint Appendix 376, Your Honor. The testimony regarding the business agent, this is from the employees themselves, Bond. In fact, there was a little bit of a confrontation between the two employees and the business agent because they thought the business agent had sold them down the river. And it's at pages 144 to 145 of the joint appendix reference.
Is that Rhea?
That's Rhea, yes, Your Honor. So that's where that was. And then lastly, I just, to Felix, because I do think that you cannot read the board's, in my opinion, regardless of the differences in the facts, you cannot read the board's decision here consistent with Felix. The board found in this case that there were remarks made. They had to count in some fashion against the employee. Maybe the board has some discretion as to how much they counted. They couldn't possibly have counted in favor of protection. And I think that's what Felix makes clear. So I don't think this case can possibly stand under the Felix analysis. Thank you.
Thank you.